John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drop?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, January 5th, 2012. A Palestinian dies in a tunnel collapse in the Gaza Strip, and Israel bars some settlers from the West Bank. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian tax revenues collected by Israel, accounting to 150 million shekels, $39 million, will be transferred to Gaza upon their release in the next 24 hours, the head of the Palestinian Monetary Authority said on Thursday. The cash injection is intended to solve a critical shortage of currency in the blockaded Gaza Strip, Palestinian Monetary Authority Governor Jihad al-Wazir said at an address to business students at the Islamic University in Gaza City. In the West Bank, Israeli forces demolished two homes belonging to Jerusalem families in the village near the West Bank city of Jericho on Thursday. Bulldozers accompanied by military patrols tore down the homes in Ain el-Duke west of Jericho and also destroyed the electricity connection to the site. Israeli forces told the owners the houses were built without a permit in Area C, which Israel fully controls under the 1993 Oslo Accords. In the Gaza Strip, a man was killed and another injured when a tunnel collapsed under the border with Egypt in the southern part of the Strip on Thursday morning. Bilal Shaat, 24, from Khan Yunis, died while working in the underground passage near As-Salam neighborhood in southern Rafah. An injured colleague was transferred to Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah for treatment. Since Israel tightened its blockade on the Gaza Strip in 2007, goods smuggled in from Egypt through underground tunnels have provided a lifeline to the coastal enclave. In other news, Israel has barred a dozen Jewish settlers from the occupied West Bank for a period of up to 1 year, a step Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had pledged to take to rein in violence against Israeli military and Palestinians. A statement issued on Thursday by Israel's military said police, quote, delivered administrative restraining orders, unquote, to 12 people described as, quote, Jewish extremists, unquote, from the territory. It said these men were suspected of involvement in violence targeting Palestinians and Israeli forces and described the orders issued as, quote, preventive measure to remove the threat by the activists in the area, unquote. One of the men has been barred from the territory for a year, the rest for periods of 3 to 9 months, a military spokeswoman said, and declined to provide further details. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was Thursday, January 5th, daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This was brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Fishman.
Palestinians under Israeli occupation experience many restrictions on their day-to-day lives, from lack of water and electricity to restrictions on movement to violence at the hands of Israeli settlers in the Israeli army. Outside Bethlehem, the Nasser family is struggling to hold on to its 100 hilltop acres, which the Israeli government is trying to seize to build more settlements, adding to those that already surround the Nasser farm. The family is working towards self-sufficiency on their farm they call Tent of Nations, as life grows ever more difficult for them and residents of the nearby village of Nahalin. Jihan Nasser lives on the hilltop with her family. She's trained in computer technology and 5 years ago set up a women's learning center in Nahalin. There, she and international volunteers offer computer training, English language courses, health education and farming techniques to dozens of mostly young village women. On a recent trip to Israel, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jihan Nasser about her work in the village, the challenges she's had to overcome, and the difficulties the women she trains still face.
We have volunteers who come here and teaches some of these classes. For example, I also teach computer classes. We have a computer lab. And for example, English classes, we have people coming from America, from UK, from Switzerland, from Germany. They come here, women, and they give those English classes. We have also art workshops. We do. We have so many interested women from all over the world who comes here. We have from Japan, we have from Sweden, we have from Switzerland again, Germany, USA. They come here, and from Italy, they come here and they also do, for example, art workshops with the women to produce like pieces of art, and maybe we can sell it somewhere to the people who comes and visit here, and sometimes in Bethlehem in the shops. We have also a group for embroidery. We do embroidery also with the women. The aim of this is to make those women independent, to be able to survive in those conditions in the village, bad conditions. Some of their fathers and brothers, they don't work, so there is no income coming to the house. So it's not easy for those girls to ask the mothers or the fathers for their needs. For example, one story that some of them, they can't, for example, afford to have pads for their periods. So, for example, you know, doing those workshops in art and embroidery, maybe it's good to sell those things, and for, you know, the income will come directly to them to support them and to be able to buy anything they want, you know, without asking the father or the brother.
The women here are all Muslim, right, in the class?
All of them are Muslims.
And that you're a Christian family.
Right.
But you're all Palestinian.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any kind of tension or difficulty?
At the beginning, when I started 5 years ago, coming to a very conservative village was not easy. You know, I'm not wearing a veil like all of them, and I'm not Muslim. At the beginning, I had some difficulties. I don't want to say difficulties, but they asked me so many questions about me, my faith, about being a Palestinian Christian, and how I pray, and how many times, and all these things. And I always said to them, look, I am Palestinian, I speak Arabic, and I live in Palestine. So I am like you guys, but my religion is different. So it's good also to give them an idea about my religion. It's always good to introduce them to our religion from that perspective in classes, not directly, you know.
So if they're here, I guess that means they don't have a problem with their fathers or husbands having them come here?
You know, at the beginning, we did have a problem. You know, usually the men used to ask. They used to call me and tell me, what are you doing in the village? What are these courses? Why you are doing these courses here, not in another village, you know? And what they are learning in the classes. And if they are convinced, they will register the wife or the sister. And if not, they will say, it's okay, you know. But it's good that they used to call me, the men, and tell me, please register my woman in this class or that class. But I also want to hear it from the women themselves, to be able to call or come to the center and tell me, I want to be in this class or that class. And I think it's now it's changing since 5 years, and I've been having so many women coming by themselves with their kids, coming here, and now I am famous in the village. They know, where are you going? I'm going to Jihan. They don't say, we are going to the women's center. They say, we are going to Jihan. So even the fathers and the brothers, they know Jihan. We focus every year on a different group of women. And since 2 years, since last year and this year, I decided to help those, let me call them desperate girls, who dropped out from school at very young age and they don't know what to do and where to go. And they are so desperate. We have every day, we have in the morning, we have a session for 1 hour. We talk about our problems. And it's really sad to hear those stories for those, you know, those problems for those young girls. I mean, sometimes, you know, I feel so upset and I go home and it's too upsetting, you know, and sometimes you don't know what to do, how to help. But as I said before, it's good to listen to them and to hear those problems. And sometimes it's good to give them, you know, encouragement and to lift their spirits up, you know, and to be patient and all of that. And I tell them always, just get out of the house, come here, meet us, and sometimes socialize and get to know other friends, get to know other women, hear another problem from another woman, and be, you know, together and, you know, back each other.
That was Jihan Nasir, who runs a women's center in the West Bank village of Nahalin. For more information on the women's center, visit our website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan today. NATO is reporting the deaths of 5 soldiers of unspecified nationality from IED attacks in undisclosed locations in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan yesterday. NATO is reporting the deaths of 3 soldiers of unspecified nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Pakistan ongoing. NATO vehicles stopped at the closed border with Afghanistan have been moved back from the border to Karachi for security reasons. The border has been closed since a U.S. airstrike killed 24 Pakistani soldiers, and those container and tanker trucks stopped at the border have been sitting ducks ever since. Baghdad, Iraq, today. 2 rockets landed in the still-fortified green zone housing the U.S. embassy, the largest U.S. embassy in the world. Iraqi government offices are also in the green zone. The rockets didn't cause any casualties, but may be a sign of things to come. U.S. troops may be out, but that huge U.S. embassy and tens of thousands of mercenaries are still in Iraq. Meanwhile, the Iraqi government teeters as sectarian violence explodes, with at least 76 dead and 147 wounded just in Thursday's brutal sectarian bombings. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. 3 bombs went off in Sadr City in Baghdad, killing at least 24 people and wounding at least 35 people. One was in a motorcycle, 2 on a roadside near a spot where day laborers gathered to look for work. In Syria, Iraq, yesterday. A suicide bombing in Nusayr killed 48 Shiite pilgrims at a checkpoint on the road to Karbala. A security officer tackled the bomber in an attempt to stop the attack, but was blown up when the bomb detonated anyway. Baghdad, Iraq, today. 2 more Shiite pilgrims were killed in another pair of brutal sectarian bombings. Iraq, ongoing. With waves of attacks aimed at Shiites and U.S. troops out,
influential Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has returned to Iraq. He is calling for a referendum in an effort to put a stop to the sectarian warfare that is consuming the country. There is suspicion that the Thursday bombings are an attempt by al-Qaeda to force the Mahdi army to go to war against the Sunni, making the country ungovernable and forcing the rest of the Sunni community to join with al-Qaeda for mutual defense, a strategy they are believed to have used in 2006. Mr. Barack Obama, all this violence stems from the U.S. invasion back in 2003. Surely you don't see Iraq today as a viable model for Afghanistan. If not, there's no reason, with bin Laden dead, for U.S. troops to keep fighting there. Why should D.C. National Guard members still be saying goodbye to their families at the D.C. Armory? As the Washington Post said, this is 2012, not 2002. Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops and all the mercenaries home from all these wars today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
On New Year's Eve, Occupy Wall Street, reoccupy Zuccotti Square, and march to the streets of Lower Manhattan. At midnight, it was reported that Occupy Wall Street had torn down the fences erected after they were evicted and arrested seven tenants in their place. In response, they were met with a sickening chorus of police brutality, both in the park and on the street. At least 68 people were arrested, some with brutal force.
I can't breathe!
You what?
Occupy Wall Street's live stream video observers were physically thrown out of areas under attack instead of arrested in a futile attempt by the New York police to conceal their crimes. At one point, the pigs blockaded the sidewalk, pushed a street march into the blockade, then threatened to arrest everyone inside for blockading the sidewalk in a repeat of their unlawful trap and detain strategy that resulted in a class action lawsuit after 700 people were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. One protester was charged with a felony for allegedly trying to defend himself from the mindless police brutality with a pair of scissors. His lawyer says the police claim of being slashed with the scissors is bullshit, and given the history of lies from the New York cops about Occupy Wall Street, I'm inclined to believe him. No matter how satisfying it would be if people really did start to resist police brutality with armed force. At least the judge denied the NYPD's request for $12,000 bail, and he was released on $500 bail instead. Here's what the police attack on Occupy Wall Street sounded like. That scene was from an incident where Occupy Wall Street did in fact manage to force the police to retreat from an attempt to arrest someone, though no weapons were used. Instead, everyone grabbed onto the young man the police were trying to brutalize and dragged him to safety while swarming protesters held the pigs at bay. No scissors were used, and unfortunately no cop got his grabbing, choking hand slashed off of someone's neck. Cops lie, video tells the truth. Meanwhile, here in D.C., park police tried to search tents that occupy D.C. over New Year's Eve, only to scatter like cockroaches when the light comes on when the livestream videographer was summoned to record their misconduct. A guerrilla artwork was installed at Occupy D.C. December 30th, ripped down by the park police on December 31st, and reinstalled on January 2nd. On January 3rd, the park police again tried to remove it, only to give up after protesters picked it up as a unit and demonstrated that it is portable. Meanwhile, Occupy DC was threatened with eviction on the 2nd of January unless her kitchen was brought up to the codes affecting commercial restaurants. In 3 months, Nobody has gotten sick eating at Occupy DC, yet on the coldest day of the year, the kitchen tent is closed because of this order. The kitchen crew is attempting to comply with these commercial codes and promises to reopen within 2 days. Congress cowers in fear of Occupy DC. That's the reason the reflecting pool area between 1st and 3rd Streets is being transferred to Capitol Police jurisdiction. You know what's coming on the 17th of January. Huh!
Library closing alert. Library closing alert. East Bank is back with their plans to demolish the West End Library. And although they promised to rebuild it, they were also promising affordable housing as part of their proposed planned unit development, and now they're trying to get out of it. On the 5th of January, the D.C. Zoning Commission held a public hearing about East Bank's proposed planned unit development that would, among other things, tear down the West End Library and the nearby firehouse. Maybe they would be replaced, but maybe not, too, depending on what kind of muscle East Bank can apply to the D.C. government. This is the same redevelopment plan that outraged West End residents and library supporters stopped in summer 2007. That time around, public hearings were held on such dates as July 5th in an effort to evade public scrutiny, but East Bank's behavior backfired and the council's approval was rescinded that fall. Now East Bank is back with essentially the same proposal, possibly with the affordable housing sweetener for the deal stripped out or scaled back. In 2010, the city council quietly passed similar legislation to allow the project, but East Bank wants even more, based on their hopes to remove the affordable housing offered in return for the library and the firehouse. They want to build condominiums, luxury condominiums, in the place of everything that currently stands there. I was unable to enter the hearing due to intrusive and detailed bag searches at 441 4th Street, where the Zoning Commission meets. Here is an interview with another D.C. resident who managed to get in, but had to leave before he could testify because supporters of East Bank droned on and on for an hour and a half. He would have had to stay several additional hours in order to be heard.
Well, the portion of the hearing that I attended, they heard from parties, meaning legal parties to the case, testified some in favor of the proposed development and some against the proposed zoning variance that East Bank is seeking.
What kind of variance are they seeking?
They're seeking to be able to build higher and closer to the property lines in exchange for building the library and the firehouse, even though of course, as it stands now, the land that the library and the firehouse sit on belong to the public, so seeking a variance for that doesn't really make sense.
So they want a variance in return for using public land?
Essentially, yes.
And did they in fact try to get out of the conditions requiring them to build a certain percentage of affordable housing?
East Bank did not present at the meeting while I was there. However, many people, even those testifying in support of the variance for East Bank, stated that East Bank was seeking to decrease the number of affordable housing units that would be built there, and East Bank, which had opportunity to challenge that statement, did not do so. So that indicates that, yes, they are in the open seeking to reduce the number of affordable units.
What percentage of people there were for and what percentage were against this development?
Well, the way the hearing was structured, first they heard from the parties in support, then individuals in support, then parties against, and individuals against. And so there were, I would say, 7 to 8 parties or organizations in support, and maybe 5 or 6 individuals in support. And after that, the parties against was beginning, and they had gone through 3 or 4 of those, and there were more after I was leaving.
So my guess is by having parties against last to make it as difficult as possible for citizen opposition to be heard.
I mean, I stayed for about an hour and a half of the meeting, and they had not yet begun individual opposition to the project.
That's typical. And on top of all else, the Zoning Commission meets in a building with bag searches and metal detectors, and some people can't even get in.
Yeah. Another thing is that the emergency legislation that the D.C. Council passed in 2007 was rescinded because of public outcry about disposing of the property in this way. The reasons that they cited for getting rid of this property, among them, were as follows. There exists an immediate need to dispose of these lots that the property sit on in order for the district to create job opportunities and affordable housing units units for district residents. So if they're
weren't they going to tear down an apartment?
If they're citing that as justification for why it needs to be disposed of, and then saying, well, we want fewer affordable units, that doesn't make any sense. They also said the District of Columbia Public Library will not have capital funds to replace the West End Branch Library until the years 2011.
So better to
through 2013, which is now.
So it's better to have no library?
So there should be money in the budget for this anyway, and the district doesn't need East Bank to pay for it.
And who's that fat slug? Joe Sternley?
The fat guy is Anthony Lanier.
Anthony Lanier.
Who's the head of East Bank, and the vice president of East Bank, who you mentioned, is Joe Sternley, who at the time of this emergency legislation passing was married to the attorney general of the city, Linda Singer. So when there were an opinion was sought as to whether emergency legislation should be allowed for the disposition of public property when no real emergency exists, one of the parties involved was sleeping with the Attorney General.
Interesting. And of course, their first hearing on that was held on the 5th of July 2007 in an attempt to evade the public, which failed.
That's correct. Yep, and so that legislation was rescinded under public pressure in September of 2007.
So in the absence of that legislation, what is the situation for East Bank if they don't get their variance and don't get any help from the D.C. government?
The D.C. Council, subsequent to that, did pass similar legislation to the first disposition.
Just waiting the public out?
If they don't get the zoning variance, I don't know what they would do, but it seems to me that they actually could afford to not get the zoning variance and build the affordable units, so maybe that would happen, but I don't know what they would do.
Sounds like we need to encourage everybody to say no to this variance.
Well, there certainly were, you know, a number of neighborhood residents who did not support the project. There were some who did, and there were some who didn't. So it certainly was far from consensus.
A lot of people in the West End have not forgotten the last time those fat pigs at East Bank tried to shut down the West End Library. On the 4th of January, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society ship Bob Barker moved in on the illegal Japanese whaling fleet. The whalers have fled more than 1,500 miles since they were first detected by Sea Shepherd drone aircraft. Although one ship, the fast trimaran Brigitte Bardot, is out for the season after being damaged by a rogue wave, the other two ships, plus the drones, are still in the fight. Bob Barker is out battling the whales. The Bob Barker is out battling the whalers right now, and the Steve Irwin is racing back after towing the Brigitte Bardot back to port. Here's an interview by ABC News with Paul Watson of Sea Shepherd.
David Weber reports from Fremantle.
The Brigitte Bardot has a severely damaged pontoon and will be repaired at a cost of about $200,000. Paul Watson says the future success of the operation doesn't rely on the trimaran.
It actually hasn't turned out to be a major setback because we found the fleet and we're pursuing them. And we're also, the Brigitte Bardot was our scout vessel, but we have the added advantage this year of having a drone aircraft that can fly within 300 miles and search out for the fleet. And that's how we're keeping tabs on the Nishan Maru.
Mr. Watson says it's the first time in 8 seasons that a Sea Shepherd vessel has suffered such serious damage.
Nothing's really appropriate down there. It's pretty hostile conditions. But last year, the Brigitte Bardot went down way down into the Ross Sea and was handled without any problems. It wasn't ice conditions, it was weather conditions. And the Brigitte Bardot was built to go, it set a world record for going around the world. And it's built for those conditions. It's a wave-piercing trimaran. But, you know, any vessel can be hit by an unexpected rogue wave, and this is what's happened here. Every time you go to the Southern Ocean, lives are in danger, so that's certainly what everybody expects. It doesn't matter what your objective, if you go down there, you're taking those risks.
Paul Watson says the whaling fleet seems to be weaker every year, while the Sea Shepherd campaign becomes stronger. But he also asserts that the Japanese have invested more funds in security, and he expects the Steve Irwin will be shadowed when it leaves Fremantle.
They put more water cannons on. Yesterday they smashed one of our radars with those water cannons. This Shona Maru, which is lurking outside of Fremantle waiting for us to come out right now, it's actually quite comical because when we flew over and documented what's on board. They're all dressed like ninjas, or like black head to toe with masks on, you know, so it seems a little bit of an overkill there.
Humane Society International has expressed concern at the presence of the Japanese security vessel. The Greens Senator, Rachel Seward, says the Australian government should be taking more action.
The federal government needs to be telling the Japanese government that that ship is not welcome in our waters. It should not be shadowing the Sea Shepherd, and it should be putting a boat into the water and sending that customs vessel down with the Sea Shepherd to monitor what the Japanese whaling fleet is doing in our southern waters.
The Steve Irwin is expected to leave Fremantle Port for the Southern Ocean this evening.
David Webber reporting.
Today, the whalers report that two Sea Shepherd small boat teams deployed prop fowlers, ropes intended to tangle propellers, against a whale-killing harpoon ship, Yushin Maru No. 3. They can cry all they want. The whales will thank Sea Shepherd for stopping the killing.